the streets are screaming now. Greetings, 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, two big events this past week. They're ongoing. And what do they mean for the U.S. and global economy? I'm talking about impeachment, and I'm talking about the coronavirus. Okay, we're going to talk about those two topics here. And we're going to talk about the impact they have on the trade deal with China and the tech war with China, which is going to accelerate, is accelerating now. We also want to talk about what's going on in the U.S. Political scenes here, because that is going to have economic implications as well. Let's start out with impeachment. You know, what do we see here going on? Well, what we see is the culmination of decades of progressive infringement on democratic practices and precedents and institutions functioning ever since 1994. You know, my book just released here, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, what I argue is that this progressive, step-by-step, incremental limiting of democracy and actually destroying of democratic norms and democratic practices and even rules. And now we see institutions and the Constitution itself. This has been going on, as I said, since the early 1990s when Newt Gingrich took over and his right-wingers took over the House of Representatives and declared openly, publicly that you know, our whole function is, our whole purpose is to create a dysfunctional U.S. Congress. Dysfunctional. In other words, does not work. And that would frustrate people. And not seeing that the Congress was doing its job for all of the people, people would get discontent and they would then turn on Congress and elect radicals. And by, you know, Gingrich, radicals meant his group, which of course were radicals. You know, they're the source of the Tea Party later that emerged out of their group. All right, so it begins way back in 1994 when the whole idea is to create a dysfunctional U.S. government. And they've done it very successfully after 25 years of effort, step by step. Neoliberalism requires the opening, getting democracy out of the way in order to expand its increasingly aggressive, virulent policies. So you have to see that the restructuring, the destruction and restructuring of the U.S. political system going on before our eyes is a consequence of the political and economic changes that have been in progress ever since the 1990s. My book, Chapter 9, shows the examples of this, traces this whole thing, showing how, you know, we have this creeping voter suppression, we have gerrymandering, how these Gingrich right-wing forces have were able to take over a lot of the small states' legislatures. That gives them an electoral college advantage. It also allows them to press more voter suppression and gerrymandering, which is what they've done, this red state strategy. It's an Achilles heel. This U.S. federalism, American federalism, is Achilles heel of democracy, along with the Electoral College and the Supreme Court. Because in my Chapter 9, I talk about how the Supreme Court has increasingly been a defender of a of the executive branch, you know, and of those forces that have been deepening their control, those right-wing forces of the U.S. Institutions, you know, political institutions. They've been taking it over from the inside, and they've been increasingly successful in doing so. This red state strategy I'm talking about, swinging the Supreme Court in their favor, you know, Citizens United and everything that ordained, and still having consequences. Gore versus Bush and selecting of the president. You know, the Supreme Court is an aberration, a constitutional aberration. You know, we've bought this idea of the three branches of government checking and balancing each other. Well, the U.S. Constitution says nothing about the Supreme Court playing that role. It says nothing about the Supreme Court having the power and authority to negate the decisions of the elected representatives of the people, the Congress, the Parliament, the legislature. It says nothing. The Constitution simply said that the Congress, the legislature, should, after the passage of the Constitution, pass a judiciary law. So the whole authority of the Supreme Court and the judiciary stems from the authority of the legislature, the Congress, the elected sovereign representatives of the people, who are fundamentally and originally the source of sovereignty. You see, the people delegate that sovereignty to their representatives for a short period of time when they elect them. But that sovereignty, which is the bedrock of democracy, exists in the people. Where the hell does the Supreme Court come into this picture? They're not even elected. We don't even delegate any authority to them. Well, they usurped that authority in 1803. Madison versus Marbury decision, where the Supreme Court simply assumed for itself the authority to do what's called judicial review. In other words, declare laws passed by the representatives of the people unconstitutional. Nobody gave them that authority in the Constitution. Now, wisely, they didn't exercise it for decades, but then after the 1860s, when we really began to get a deepening capitalism and industrial capitalism in this country, they started exercising it, and they've been exercising it ever since. And we see the most egregious examples of that in Citizens United and Gore versus Bush, where they selected the president, stopped the voting. And what do we got now with this impeachment trial? We've got this guy, Justice Roberts, sitting there, sort of, being the judicial mediator. And he may be called upon to vote whether to have witnesses in this so-called trial. He may be called upon. If we have a tie vote, you know, what's going on right now today is that the Republicans have been stifling any calling of witnesses and documentation. And there's three Republican senators who may vote for witnesses. The Democrats have 47, right? And they need three more. Actually, they need four more to call witnesses. And three of them, Romney, Murkowski of Alaska, and Collins of Maine, who's in big trouble politically, so she said she would call the witnesses. That gives a 50-50. They were hoping Lamar Alexander of Tennessee would also vote for witnesses, but he came out last night and said, no, he's not. So now we got the prospect of a 50-50 tie. And then we have Justice Roberts. Now, where do you think Roberts is going to come down on this? Yeah, if he's got to break a tie, he's going to break it in favor of the Republicans. Where does he come from? He's a big corporate lawyer for decades. Big corporate lawyer, anti-labor corporate lawyer. And Bush put him in. And, of course, immediately we get Citizens United and all the other decisions that have flowed from that. Okay, so don't be they'll be surprised if those three senators, Republicans, join the Democrats and say, hey, it's not a joining to vote to acquit or not, Trump. I mean, he's going to get acquitted. Because what you got here in this transformation of the political system is representatives who are more loyal to their party than they are to the country. You know, James Madison warned of that way back, in the debates, the Federalist debates. You can go read it, Federalist Papers, right? In the debates. He said the big threat to the democracy and the Constitution would be party factions, that representatives would not vote based on what their individual constituents wanted or what was good for the country. They would vote based on their party loyalty. And that's all that's happening here. That's what's happening with the Republicans and the Trump. Well, actually, you know, they become Trump-publicans. I don't even call them Republicans anymore. They're Trump-publicans. They are so terrified that Trump's right-wing base may be turned out against them in the primaries, and they will not get even the Republican nomination, because that's happened several times already, a threat. This right-wing movement threat is used by Trump to intimidate his own party and to purge the Republicans, which has been going on. He's been purging them. So all you have left are these sycophants. You know, he's been purging anybody, including generals in his administration who didn't agree with him. He's thrown them out, right? Even threw out Bolton because he didn't like whether Bolton agreed with him or not. So what we got, you know, is a transformation of the political parties and a situation where these Republicans vote party line rather than what's good for the country. I mean, look, what they're creating here is this image of a phony trial. I mean, they've got the vote to acquit him meaning Trump. It doesn't matter if they have witnesses. If they were smart, they would allow the witnesses because they still have the votes, but they're so worried that, well, the witnesses may say something that might turn the votes. So they don't want witnesses. What a trial. A trial without witnesses. Yeah. And without documentation. I mean, look, I'm no friend of Democrats, but in this case, they're right. It's there for everybody to see. It's there. What's happening to American democracy and the Constitution, because it's very clear the House has responsibility to bring charges. Now, you can argue whether this amounts to this charge against Trump having to do with Ukraine, peddling foreign intervention in U.S. elections to help him get elected. You can argue whether that amounts to a impeachable, convictable offense or not. But it's really something that's happening on a regular basis now in U.S. politics. This isn't the first time, by the way. Okay, so we've got this transformation of the Supreme Court. We got a transformation of the political parties. And we got our election processes being tainted increasingly by voter suppression and gerrymandering. And what we've got is a changing of the Constitution itself, de facto change, right? Because now what it says, what it means, what all this means is that to impeach a president, you have to have control of both houses of Congress, right? Both houses. Or it's going to get nowhere because of this party loyalty thing among the representatives. Well, it's very rare that you have both houses of Congress in one party's hand and the presidency in the other. Very rare. Which means impeachment is almost null and void as a means of checking the executive. What we're seeing today is the dawn of the imperial presidency in domestic affairs. You know, Congress has given up its war powers decades ago. Democrats in the House are feebly trying to take it back to no avail. He's almost a dictator in foreign policy, and we've seen the presidents getting us into wars after wars. And now it's in domestic affairs, because if this guy or any president is virtually unimpeachable unless you have both houses of Congress, which is rare, then what's going to stop Trump from doing the same thing for the rest of this election period, and if he gets elected for the next 4 years, even more so? What's going to stop him from eliciting even more foreign influence or something else in foreign affairs? Nothing. Nothing. He's not impeachable now for virtually nothing. And as he blatantly declared, you know, he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and his base would support him. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty arrogant. It tells you where he's really thinking, right? And where he's really going to go. And what about domestic affairs, right? Trump has already diverted monies allocated by the House, which is in the Constitution. Only the House can pass taxes and legislate and allocate funds and so forth. He's already reallocated those funds to whatever his pet projects are. In other words, he's violated the Constitution there. And throughout the whole past year or so, obstruction, which is impeachable offenses, massive obstruction here. I mean, just stonewalling Congress, right? Saying to Congress, to the House, I'm not going to let anybody testify there. I'm not going to let any documents come out. And now this thing about Bolton and his book has come out, where Bolton has said, yeah, he's guilty. He said it. But now the Trump administration is blocking the publication of the book because it says, oh, this is all national security stuff. They won't let it come out. And when it does come out, it's going to be so purged of passages that it won't be the original book. We'll never see the original Bolton book because they're already working on editing it. In other words, Trump and the administration editing it. So American people won't know what actually happened. And the same to anybody when they eventually leave the Trump administration, they won't be able to say. Censorship, always a hallmark of dictatorship, censorship going on, deepening here. Also part of the decline of democracy. Okay, so what's going to stop him from doing what he wants domestically in terms of legislation? Nothing. This guy is going to be emboldened now by this. And he's going to be even more aggressive. He's going to attack democracy even more through this election. And should he get reelected, which he has a good chance, then it'll be even worse next term. Yeah. Okay, so decline of democracy. We're witnessing it right before our very eyes here. This is history in the making. This is the circumscribing of the U.S. Constitution and deleting, de facto deleting of the several clauses that are no longer going to be effective in the Constitution. This is a transformation that we're seeing of the political parties and the role of the judiciary. And if you don't think that there's going to be more voter suppression and gerrymandering, and who knows what he's cooking up in case he loses the election, which will be very narrow if he does, who knows what he's cooking up? Yeah, he's not going to stop and say and hand over the reins of power. Look, this is 1856 all over again, folks. We are on the cusp of a further division of the country. And this is Trump's doing. Well, he's accelerated it, that's for sure. It goes back to Gingrich, you know, and George W. Bush and Cheney, you know, and all the neocons. This is what they want. And, you know, they're getting it. They're getting it. This is a creeping legalist takeover. of the U.S. political system. Okay. We'll be talking more, I'm sure, about the implications of this. I've been posting a number of tweets here on these issues as they occur, about the swing vote. Alexander here, who says Trump did it, right? I admit that it was inappropriate, but I'm not going to vote to convict him, right? All right, and of course, another tweet. What's to stop him by violating domestic legislative congressional norms? Nothing here, right? Third parties, political parties are factions. Madison undermining the Constitution right before our eyes. Okay. And by the way, Fox News released a poll here this past week that said 50% of American voters of all political persuasions favor Trump's conviction and removal. 50%. Right? Okay. Interesting. That's going to rise. More divisions in the country. More divisions going to happen. And by the way, this is pretty much given the deep six to Joe Biden. Joe Biden is going to fade here. And we're going to see even more intense attacks on Sanders. They've already tamed Warren. They've already did a trip on Warren. They, meaning the media and so forth. And the Trump forces, and that's resulted in her falling. She was on a momentum there, and now she's slipping back. Now they're focusing on Sanders. Big attacks on Sanders coming from all directions. Hillary Clinton comes out, Kamala Harris comes out, Warren jumps in, New York Times, Paul Krugman, and all the rest, they're all going after Sanders now because he's surging in the polls. He will probably win Iowa unless they steal it from him again, because they stole it from him last time, Now, well, we'll see what happens here, but this fight, is going to continue within the Democratic Party as well. Well, let's move on. Coronavirus. What is this? Oh, well, you know what it is, right? But do you know that in the city of Wuhan, before they implemented the quarantine, 5 million people left. 5 million people spreading out all over China and traveling. These are probably more well-to-do people who have the financial means, wherewithal, right, to get out of Wuhan and to be able to support themselves somewhere else, and probably are jumping on planes to get out of China altogether. This is a very contagious virus, very contagious. Almost daily, they're adding 2,000 more cases in China, and that's going to accelerate. I saw one estimate last week that said, there were like 7,000 cases in China, but by the middle of February, there'll be 190,000 cases. China has attempted to quarantine off the cities around Wuhan. You can't quarantine an entire province, maybe a city, but not a province. It's too late for the city. And it's too late for the province. Foreign governments, including the U.S., are flying their diplomats out of the area and probably out of China here very shortly. There's already contagion in Europe, right? Already in the U.S. And here's another thing that bothers me, they fly people out of China, U.S. does, right? Sends them to Alaska and then to California, and only screens them for 72 hours. Now look, it takes 2 weeks for a virus to incubate before you get any signs of infection, like fevers and so forth. Well, they're just looking at people to say 3 days, well, you got a fever, not okay, go ahead. You know, big mistake. 72 hours, big mistake. Should do what the Australians are doing. Anybody coming from China gets sent to Christmas Island, which is an island off the northwest coast of Australia. And they get quarantined, presumably for 2 weeks. Yeah, they can't even step into Australia. That's a reasonable solution here, because this thing is not only a disaster. And by the way, how did it originate is interesting. You know, China's had a problem with swine flu and swine diseases for years now, several years now. It's quite possible that this virus mutated and jumped from pigs to humans, because pigs' DNA is very close to human DNA, in case you didn't know it. I don't know what that means, but it's true, biologically. You know, right after other great apes, like chimps and so forth, which Ebola probably leaped from. So the swine problem, or maybe this habit of eating wild animals. You know, but I think it's probably the DNA jump from swine to human beings here, mutated. So we got this problem of coronavirus spreading very rapidly. And watch India. You know, no one's saying anything about India yet. But if it jumps to India, you're going to see an acceleration of this worldwide epidemic. Now, what's the economic consequences of all this is the question. Well, they're very obvious. First of all, China's economy is going to slow dramatically now, this quarter. Very dramatically. You know, China has always been saying its growth is about 6% GDP. I've never believed that. I think it's more like 4%. They don't report it. And this is going to drop dramatically. And if it goes more than 3 months, which it will, it could drop to zero. Now, what does that mean? If China's growth pretty much slows rapidly and comes to a standstill, what it means is China stops buying commodities from around the world. It's already cutting back dramatically on oil and natural gas imports and other commodities as well. Raw materials and foodstuffs will drop dramatically. Well, if that means those countries around the world that provide those raw materials and energy to China are going to contract as well. I'm talking about, you know, Latin America. I'm talking about other oil companies, countries around the world, you know, South Africa, Nigeria, Indonesia, places like that, where you get iron ore, where you get aluminum ore, and all these other, you know, important metals, industrial metals, and foodstuffs, soybeans, etc. That's all going to contract around the world. It's going to mean that Chinese investment and consumer spending contracts. And with that, you're going to see the Chinese currency, the yuan. Already, the offshore yuan is depreciating. The big fear of Trump and his trade war was that China would depreciate its currency to offset the U.S. tariffs, which would easily be done. The Chinese did not do that, but now market forces will do that, and they have no control over that. Well, they could buy, try to buy up the yuan in global markets. That might slow it. But we're going to see a big contraction of the yuan, Chinese currency. And that's going to force a depreciation of other currencies elsewhere around the world. Yeah. And that depreciation of currencies elsewhere is going to deepen the recessions and the contraction of those economies. And that's going to cause capital flight out of those economies, slowing those economies even further. And their depreciation is going to raise the price of imports that they're dependent on and slow their export sales, which means they're going to run out of dollars and currencies for trade, and the IMF is going to have to step in, et cetera, et cetera. this thing will snowball. And it already shows signs of doing that. Big impact on the global economy. And that's why today you see the U.S. stock markets down more than 500. I don't know, 500 points here at midday when I looked at it. I think it's going to go further than that. And that's even before the China stock markets open up on Monday, which is going to witness a big, big crash, probably, of stock prices in China. That will then reverberate, in turn, globally. So you see, the contagion of this virus is not just biological. The contagion is economic contagion through the currencies, through the markets, and through demand for commodities and products and so forth. That's all but going to undermine the phase one China-U.S. deal. Remember that? Signed not too long ago? Where, according to Trump, Chinese were going to buy $100 billion of new goods this year and $100 billion next year, $200 billion. That's all you read in the press, right? Well, China never agreed to that. You know, you could read little stories buried, deep in the New York Times that said, well, China didn't necessarily agree to that. What they agreed to, or you'd read it by Reuters online or something, what they agreed to is they do their best to purchase more at the same level they were purchasing 3 years ago before the trade war. But all that depended on market demand and consumer demand in their own country, which now is collapsing. You know, they were going to buy officially, the target was $73 billion this year. Maybe a third of that, at least, U.S. oil and natural gas. That's not going to happen now. With a contracting economy, they don't need as much oil and natural gas. And they're not going to do it. So maybe $40 billion, maybe $50 this year, maybe, depending on how worse this virus hits the Chinese economy. No. You know, this is going to be the end of the China-U.S. trade deal and all that hype. And that's not good for Trump in his election, right? We're not going to see anywhere near $200 billion or even $73 billion or even $50 billion maybe this year. Forget phase two. What is phase two of this China-U.S. negotiations? It'll have nothing to do with trade. It's all about the tech war that's now erupting out in the open between China and the U.S. I've talked to this many times, next generation tech, right? We see it all in all the headlines about Huawei and 5G, 5G wireless, right? Broadband wireless, which is essential for next generation military technologies, for directing and targeting hypersonic missiles and smart torpedoes and drones and battlefield human machine coordination. You need this big pipe, this big wireless pipe called 5G, right? And AI goes, artificial intelligence goes hand in hand with that. Well, you know, the tech war is out in the open. It's decoupled from the trade war now. And you see the intensification of the tech war. The U.S. With Europe, trying to prevent Europe from going with Huawei. Yeah. I think they just lost a battle in that with the U.K. The U.K. says they're going to continue with Huawei, but I think it'll be very, very limited as part of the tech war, too, because we see this intensification this past week with the U.S. going after this Harvard professor, this chemist or some, I think he's a chemist. Yeah, they're trying to cut off all these joint R&D projects between academics in U.S. universities and China universities. They're trying to get these Chinese researchers here on visas out, drive them back to China, and put a chilling effect on U.S. professors so they don't go ahead with projects with them. And the U.S. is going to be looking at all of these projects that these academics have that relate to next generation technology, AI, Huawei, 5G, cybersecurity, all of that. Right. Also, announcement about drones. The administration has put out an announcement. Chinese parts used in U.S. drones are no longer going to be allowed. Yeah, they're severing those relationships. And Pompeo just came out with a threat yesterday, real strong threat against China. China is our big target. China is our big worry. So the tech war, decoupled from the trade war now, is going to intensify and accelerate. No more deals with China on trade. No more. At the same time, Trump signs the phony NAFTA 2.0 U.S. MCA deal. I'll be writing about that again, summarizing that. You know, there's really two USMCA deals, and I don't mean Mexico and Canada. I mean that deal negotiated initially by Trump and then the Democrats' so-called revisions to the deal. Well, first of all, the original deal really changes nothing, virtually nothing, except giving U.S. businesses more say over their investments in Mexico. There's some token stuff about protecting the pharmaceutical companies so they can charge, exorbitant prices in Mexico and Canada. That was limited. It wasn't rolled back. It was limited. And then environmental, Democrats say there's three areas we really changed this deal. One was labor dispute panels. One was big pharma pricing. And the other was environmental controls. Well, let's look at those. Environmental. You know, all they did was to move the language on environmental protection from an annex, to the original terms of the trade deal, NAFTA. You know, it was in an annex. When you put something in an annex, it doesn't have as much effect, because the language of the treaty takes precedence over the annex. An annex is like an addendum to the deal. It doesn't carry as much weight. And that's how they've been getting around the environmental effects of NAFTA here. It's only in an annex. Well, the Democrats have got the language in the annex on environment put into the main deal, the main treaty. Okay, well, that's a big improvement, huh? Not really. Pharma, big pharma. As I said, pharma wanted to charge exorbitant prices as they do here in the U.S. Well, they got it rolled back a little bit on some terms, a little bit, just a token change. And then there's the labor dispute panels. Labor dispute panels, protect labor rights and so forth. And they're supposed to have inspectors under the original Democrat proposal, labor inspectors, to make sure in Mexico they were observing labor protection rights. But Mexico said no. And what they agreed to was a panel, again, an arbitration panel. In other words, the panel, made up of managers, would decide whether the inspectors could come in. It wouldn't be unannounced labor inspection. It would be a panel first, then a labor inspection, which is the way the OSHA law works in the U.S., and that's why it's so ineffective. OSHA, government agency, Occupational Safety and Health Agency, has to tell the employer, oh, we're coming to see if you're violating the law. And, of course, the employer cleans it all up if he can. And then the inspector comes in and says, no, okay, you're clean. That's the way it works. Tell them beforehand. Well, that's the way it's going to work in Mexico as well. And if you look at the real terms and conditions, there's nothing there. Where's the there in this NAFTA 2.0? There's no limitations on Mexico movement of U.S. businesses to Mexico, and no requirements that jobs be sent back to the U.S. There's a requirement that in some factories, Mexico has to raise wages. But it doesn't say by when. There's no deadline for it. Yeah, and it's only like 40% of the factories, not all of the factories. And then there's this language that, oh, it's got to have North American content, more North American content. That doesn't mean any of the production is going to move to the U.S. or back to the U.S. No, that only means, oh, look, Mexico, you can't subcontract out to China. You know, if you want to expand, you got to do it in North America content. See, you got to do it in your own country. Well, that doesn't bring any jobs back from Mexico. It just means Mexico can't sub it out to China. You know, a report came out, the 10 big companies here that Trump was really touting as the companies that are going to bring jobs back to the U.S., you know, when he got elected, he had these 10 big companies, you know, Lockheed, GM, Ford, and so forth, right? And these are the companies that got the big tax cut, got the lion's share of the tax cut that he passed. No effect on jobs whatsoever, the study came out. Nothing. What did they do with the tax cut? Yeah, they expanded investment in the U.S., but they did it in automation. That eliminates jobs. That's what they did. Now go read the report. I think it was in the New York Times, maybe Wall Street Journal this past week. No jobs coming back. And now, with the economy about to weaken here, quite possibly, what do we see in the economy, U.S. economy? Right? Investment, business investment, continuing to contract even faster in the fourth quarter. Consumer spending holding up the economy, but softening fast in the fourth quarter. The growth in consumer spending in the fourth quarter was half of that what it was in the third quarter, and December looked really poor. And by the way, you know, a lot of that consumption is the top 10 or 20% of households. Those in the median and below aren't really participating in that consumer spending. Yeah. So, you know, the consumer spending doesn't look all that good. Yeah, we got a little boost in housing because interest rates are falling. But the economy is teetering and slowing. And this global virus effect may be just enough to push it over. And if there's a recession in this country this year, then Trump will be thrown out. Not until. What the Democrats couldn't do, what the Republicans wouldn't do in the Senate, maybe this little old virus will do. We'll see. We'll watch that very closely. But this whole economic contagion effect could accelerate very fast. And we'll be watching that. Okay. Okay, so what else news here? Brexit. Brexit finally got signed here. Today, I think, is the last day. Right? Britain will leave. Will be leaving the European Union. They will rue the day. The effects on the British economy are going to be very negative here. Because they're not going to get a new trade deal with Europe quickly. You know, that the UK and Europe depend on exports far more than the United States for their economy. And the export-import trade in goods and services movement between the two, UK and Europe, is going to plummet in the initial phase here. That's going to have a very negative effect on business in the UK, certainly in the short term, certainly. And, well, you know, the UK, they're going to, what are they going to do? They're going to cut taxes for business. And then what does that mean? Europe's going to have to cut business taxes. So, you know, then they're right in line with the U.S., see? Race to the bottom, cut taxes on investors and businesses. But it won't stimulate that economy very much in Britain. Oh, they'll try to do some spending, but not very much. And that won't stimulate it. At best, they're going to limp along stagnant. I think there's going to be a recession in Europe here. We already, you know, Germany already is there, especially if you don't just look at GDP, which is a poor indicator. Look at investment and employment and so forth. Germany is already in manufacturing recession. France, I just saw some statistics slipped into a decline here. With France and Germany, now with Brexit, certainly going to be a recession there. And then impacted because a lot of their exports and production goes to China. Well, that virus effect is going to have an impact negatively there as well. Europe's in trouble. And the UK is in even more trouble than Europe. The UK thinks they're going to turn around and get a trade deal quickly with Trump. Ha ha. If they want to sign away their economic lifeblood, they will. The U.S. will squeeze them on a deal, and they may have to go for it because they're in such a poor condition. So forget Europe. Forget a lot of emerging markets that provide commodities to China. Commodity producers, oil and commodity producers, forget them. They're going to decline further. Europe's going to slow down further. It's hard to tell what the impact's going to be on Japan and South Korea. Hard to tell. Certainly can't be good because both South Korea and Japan have moved a lot of their production facilities to North China. So as that slows down, so will those countries slow down, those economies, Japan as well. This contagion is going to, it's not a China thing anymore, it's an Asian thing, you see. And we're going to see first the response to all this in the financial markets, the stock markets. Commodity prices, oil prices falling, especially commodity prices, as China demand for these things are going to slow. And also goods exports and goods imports in turn. Back to politics. Sanders. We're going to see a big fight after the Iowa and New Hampshire primaries, should Sanders win both. The attack on him is going to intensify. There was an interesting article, I think it was in the New York Times, that widespread interviews of workers in Michigan and in the Northwest, those swing states, was done. And pretty much the thing that appeals to workers in those states is either Trump or Sanders. Trump or Sanders. Interesting. Because both are demanding one just in talk, that's Trump, right? And the other, Sanders in programs and policies, are demanding fundamental changes in the policy direction of this country. I think if you turn Sanders loose against Trump, that would be very interesting to see what the responses are of working class and folks in unions and so forth. I think Sanders would win that debate. Really. But the Democratic Party is not going to let Sanders be the nominee. There's no way, I predict. They'll do whatever they have to do to prevent it. The question is, who do they put up in lieu of him? Mike. Yeah. Bloomberg. Well, I project this scenario, that they'll do everything they can to make sure Sanders does not get enough primary votes to win on the first ballot at the Democratic convention. And then on the second vote, the Democratic Party hacks these special delegates. I think there's like 700 of them or 500 of them. Some will be released. You see, they're not supposed to vote on the first, according to the new rules of the Democratic Party, the first ballot vote. But they can come and vote on the second. Yeah, the whole idea is to prevent Sanders from getting a first ballot win at the convention, and then the delegates are loosed, and guess who they're going to vote for? It won't be Joe. It'll be Mike. I'm talking about Bloomberg. Bloomberg out there. Yeah. Look at his ads, his TV ads. He spent $250 million already on TV ads, and he'll keep spending it. He doesn't really present himself as the Democrat candidate, does he? He's just puffing himself up, making himself look good. Talking the talk, you know, that average folks want to hear about health insurance, about education costs, about housing and all these other things. He's talking the talk, but he won't walk the walk if he gets the nomination. But that's the fallback strategy. You know, use Buttigieg and Klobuchar and even Warren, who's unreliable in my view, to make sure that Sanders does not get the majority of votes in the primaries to win on the first ballot. Keep those others in the race, particularly Buttigieg and Klobuchar, keep them in the race to split the vote in the primaries. And then when the first ballot fails for Sanders, delegates will swing behind Bloomberg. Yeah, that's the plan, to prevent Sanders from getting the nomination. Yeah, so we get to vote for two billionaires this time, folks. Yeah, two billionaires. Another indication of the poor state and the decline of politics in America. Anyway, we'll see how that plays out. But that's, you know, the scenario I see most likely on the Democratic side. Of course, on the Republican side is Donald Trump. Donald Trump will really accelerate his campaign in his State of the Union address next Tuesday. He's going to really trumpet, you know, and really boast about, and that he'll use that. That'll be the most disgusting reported to the president that we've ever heard. Well, he will use it to bash the Democrats and really agitate and mobilize his base, political base, and he will escalate his attacks here. He will drive the country into deeper and deeper division starting next Tuesday and for the rest of this year. Americans will turn against each other like they never had since the 1850s. You know, we are witnessing the beginning of a kind of domestic Cold War, you might say. And it's going to be an interesting year economically. The wild card here is this virus and the global economy and the effect it will have eventually, if it continues unabated, on the U.S. economy. That will weaken Trump. Yeah. Will it be enough? Well, it remains to be seen. Remains to be seen. But politics and economics are converging here in this election year. It's really a junctural year. Could go either way. And whichever way it goes, so goes the country, so goes the economy, and so goes the United States of America. We will see a further infringing of democracy and democratic rights as never before, particularly at the state level. It'll be a green light for voter suppression and further gerrymandering. Lock in those red states, which locks in the Electoral College, which locks in Trump. Okay. Well, we'll have a lot to say next week, I believe, after the economic report of the president here, and after the collapse of Chinese stocks next week, and we'll see how that affects the economy. But it's going to be an eventful year, no doubt, and the year begins next Tuesday. Okay, that's it for today. Next week, Alternative Visions.